Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Dominic Nichols, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today we bring you the latest news from the battlefront as drone strikes on the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant risk what the UN says is a major nuclear accident. We also speak to Jimmy Rushton, a Kyiv-based security analyst, and Joe Barnes, our Brussels correspondent.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's gonna break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday, we sit down with leading journalists from The Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Monday, the 8th of April, 2 years and 44 days since the full-scale invasion began. I started by summarising the latest updates from Ukraine. Let's start, though, with the latest news from Ukraine. And the news this morning, Russia has accused Ukraine of flying military drones into the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. That's Europe's biggest such facility in the centre of the country. The drone attack has raised the risk of a, quote, major nuclear accident, the UN's atomic watchdog has warned. Now, Russia says Ukraine was behind the attack, which they say injured three people. Ukraine has denied involvement. The attack has caused no damage to the power plant's critical infrastructure. The management of the Russian-occupied facility has claimed. Now, we can't independently verify either the incident or the suggestion that there's no damage. Both Russia and Ukraine have repeatedly accused each other of shelling the power plant since the start of the full-scale invasion. Now, the head of the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, he said the drone strike, which was yesterday, he called it reckless and a major escalation of the nuclear safety and security dangers facing the plant. He said there had been at least three direct hits against the plant's main reactor containment structures. This cannot happen, he said. No one can conceivably benefit or get any military or political advantage from attacks against nuclear facilities. This is a no-go. Now, the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant was taken by Russia shortly after the start of the full-scale invasion. It stopped generating power back in 2022, but does need a constant supply of electricity to cool one of its reactors, which is in a state of hot conservation, meaning it is not fully offline. Now, the IAEA, which does have a team of experts at the plant, confirmed physical impact, what they're saying is physical impact of drone attacks at the site, including on one of the reactors. The IAEA said the damage had not compromised nuclear safety, but warned this is a serious incident with potential to undermine the integrity of the reactor's containment system. Now, the alleged series of strikes on the site came after Ukraine supposedly launched over 50 drones into Russian territory overnight into this morning, the majority targeting an airbase in the Rostov region in one of Kyiv's biggest air attacks of the war so far. Got no reports yet of the outcome of these strikes. No BDA, battle damage assessment, in military parlance, but we should have more news on that tomorrow. Then looking back over the weekend, and Russia allegedly lost seven military aircraft during what Ukraine's drone attack during a Ukrainian drone attack on Friday on the Yeysk Air Base. That's in Krasnodar Krai in Russia, on the eastern edge of the Sea of Azov, about 50 km southeast of Mariupol. This comes from a source in Ukraine's military intelligence speaking to the Kyiv Independent. Now, as well as the Yeisk air base, that wave of attacks also hit the Engels 2 and Kursk airfields elsewhere, both deep inside Russia, Engels 2 much further to the east, Kursk to the north, with a number of unidentified drones, I should say. The intelligence source in the HUR told the Kyiv Independent four Russian Sukhoi Su-30 SM fighters, two transport aircraft and one Beriev BE-200 Altair were damaged. That last one, the Beriev, is a jet-powered amphibious flying boat designed for firefighting, search and rescue, maritime patrol and other bits and bobs, personnel transportation. The attack also said to have destroyed the diesel power station at the airfield from the source. Then on to Saturday, two Russian missile and drone strikes, one in the early hours and a second in the afternoon of Saturday, killed eight, wounded at least 10 more in Kharkiv. But talking more about Kharkiv in a moment. I think, Jimmy, you've just been there recently, haven't you? You spend a lot of time there. I'll come on to that when we chat later. Strikes in the Donetsk regions of Kharkivka and Krasnorivka and in Odessa also killed and wounded civilians. And Ukraine's largest private power company, DTEC, said that recent strikes had hit 80% of its generating capacity and that the electrical grid has introduced rolling blackouts to stabilise the system. Now then, with a focus on Kharkiv, in an interview on Saturday, President Zelensky said Kharkiv is protected in case Russia attempts to launch an offensive. He said, today Kharkiv is not in danger. Now, why is he saying that? The comments follow, as we all know, the recent severe uptick in Russian attacks on the city. In this wave, first Russia went for the power infrastructure, which destroyed a thermal plant and electrical substations. And they then went for the civilian population, or are now going for the civilian population, and the emergency services. We saw that in last week's so-called double tap attacks. The first attack, which causes death and destruction, draws in first responders, and then a second attack a few minutes later is designed to kill those that have responded. Now, sticking with Kharkiv, for a number of months there have been suggestions that Russia is about to launch a ground offensive against Kharkiv. You'll remember it's Ukraine's second largest city, a population of about 1.5 to 2 million before the full-scale invasion. It's very close to the border. It's only about 20 k's from the northern edge of the city to the border with Russia. But we think there's been these reports or likely shaping in terms of Russian psychological operations for an offensive in Kharkiv because it's such a major city and it makes Kyiv have to pay attention to it and potentially divert resources. The HUR, Ukraine's military intelligence, says the whole thing is a psychological operation. They say there are no signs Moscow is preparing new attack formations to carry out a ground offensive. However, The Economist, citing undisclosed Ukrainian military sources, say the recent strikes against Kharkiv aims to turn the city into a grey zone, uninhabitable for civilians. Kharkiv Mayor Ihor Terekhov told the paper, and it's definitely a paper, it's not a magazine, they are very, very particular about that. He told The Economist that his city has no intention of giving up. He pointed out that Kharkiv had already gone through a worse situation at the start of the full-scale invasion. He said, how can you make a city like this a grey zone? People won't leave because they've already left, then returned. They've been tortured enough already. He added, the authorities have managed to keep the power going to the city without working stations or transformers, but didn't reveal exactly how for security reasons. Make of that what you will. Now then, sticking on Saturday, and President Zelensky warned Ukraine could run out of air defence missiles if Russia keeps up the tempo of its long-range bombing campaign. In an interview aired on Ukrainian television, he said, if they keep hitting Ukraine every day the way they have for the last month, we might run out of missiles and the partners know it. Partners being the international crowd, possibly dragging their feet. I don't know if that's harsh or an accurate reflection. My words. Anyway, President Zelensky said Ukraine had enough stockpiles to cope for the moment, but it was already having to make difficult choices about what to protect. And as I hinted at earlier, that might be the reason Kharkiv has been hit so hard recently. If air defence has been prioritised for Kyiv, then there will be gaps in the line somewhere, and Kharkiv is very close to Russia, as I said. Now then, finally on the military bit, Ukraine's Prosecutor General's office has opened an investigation into a video published on Russian Telegram channels yesterday that allegedly shows Russian soldiers shooting three captured and unarmed Ukrainian service personnel near Kryvyi village in Kherson Oblast The Prosecutor General's Office said in a statement on Sunday, the video shows several shots fired by a member of Russian armed forces at the unarmed and unmoving Ukrainian servicemen. The video I've seen, all the still images from it, you can't see any obvious signs of life, so we don't know exactly what was going on there, but it's caused an investigation by the Prosecutor General. Now, onto the more sort of diplomatic bits while Francis is away for today. Interesting one this today, 120 years since the start of the Entente Cordiale between Britain and France, and Lord Cameron, our Foreign Secretary, will warn the US is risking the West's security by holding up the aid package for Ukraine. He's visiting DC, Washington, DC this week. So I'll come on to that in a moment. During face-to-face meeting, the Foreign Secretary is expected to urge Mike Johnson, the House of Representatives Speaker, to stop the Republican action, his colleagues' action from blocking the support. He was speaking, Lord Cameron this is, with Stéphane Séjourné, his French counterpart. They collectively, the two of them, issued a rallying cry to boost support for Ukraine in a Telegraph article today. Hurrah. You'll find that online, marking the 120th anniversary of the Entente Cordiale. They wrote quite a lot, but I've just picked out a couple of bits and bobs. They say, we are absolutely clear Ukraine must win this war. If Ukraine loses, we all lose. Now, that's a bit stronger than the whole thing. We will stick with you for as long as it takes. So that's good. Perhaps somebody could define what winning means, but no, that is good. We are both absolutely clear Ukraine must win this war. If Ukraine loses, we all lose. The costs of failing to support Ukraine now will be far greater than the costs of repelling Putin. But as discussed during the Paris conference in February, we must do even more to ensure we defeat Russia. Interesting use of the word we there. We defeat Russia. The world is watching and will judge us if we fail. I think those are pretty strong words. They said it's not for France and Britain alone to solve these challenges, and we can rally others to join us in overcoming them. I think those are a pretty decent start to the next, however long it's going to be, the Entente Cordiale. What do you think? Then a couple more for me on the diplomatic front. US media reporting that Donald Trump will try to pressure Ukraine to cede Crimea and the Donbass border region as a price for peace with Russia. So citing, quote, people familiar with the plan, which covers a multitude of sins, the Washington Post said that the blueprint is the cornerstone of Trump's pledge to negotiate a deal between Kyiv and Moscow within 24 hours of being elected. According to the Washington Post, Mr. Trump believes that both Russia and Ukraine are looking for a face-saving way out of the war. Not sure I agree with that. Now, Donald Trump's campaign team dismissed these reports as, they said, quote, coming from unnamed and uninformed sources who have no idea what is going on or what will happen. Could be anybody, basically. Now, you'll remember last month, after meeting Mr. Trump, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban said that Donald Trump would turn off the financial taps that have helped Ukraine for so long. He said, he, Donald Trump, will not give a penny in the Ukraine-Russia war. That is why the war will end. He added that Mr. Trump had pretty detailed plans on how to end the fighting. I mean, you know, anyone's guess. And then finally for me, General Budanov's been speaking. He's been assessing the war. So he's obviously the head of the main military intelligence directorate, Lieutenant General Kirilla Budanov, the chap I met when we visited Ukraine in February. Doesn't say an awful lot. Does it all with his eyes. He said that Ukraine anticipates the Russian offensives to intensify in late spring, early summer. He was speaking to the German broadcaster ARD in an interview published yesterday, said Ukraine expects the Russian offensive operations will especially intensify in the Donbass. He said that Russian forces will likely to attempt to advance to Chasiv Yar, that's west of Bakhmut, and in the direction of Pokrovsk, that's about 40 k's northwest of Avdiivka. Now, the Institute for the Study of War, the US-based think tank, they said recently that Russian forces have intensified the tempo of their offensive operations across the entire theatre, including by conducting a roughly reinforced company-sized mechanized assault toward Chasiv Yar last Thursday, although that was broken up, decisively failed. But yeah, there we go. Now, I'm going to take a little pause there. I'm delighted to turn now to our Brussels correspondent, Joe. Joe, you've been indulging your inner train spotter, I hear. What can you tell us of a delayed rail service at the Franco-German border?
Hi, Tom. Hello, folks. Never considered myself much of a train spotter, but I do like the nerdery that makes up the battlefield behind the front line, the rear, as it would be called. And it's something I've been looking at for quite some time. So what I've been looking at in the media is a look at how German bureaucracy, aging infrastructure, and Soviet-era railway gauges, the distance between the metal railways that trains are propped up on, and how they are all potentially holding up NATO's ability to defend itself against a Russian attack. You look at all the warnings, the Germans are warning it could be 5 to 6 years. You've got people at NATO saying the next 2 decades are crucial. And NATO has its own battle plans. It's refigured how it defends itself. The American generals in charge have been looking at that carefully and drawn up all these regional plans. And while it's great, the sort of the could you get initially 100,000 troops, 300,000 troops, up to millions of troops to defend and fight a war if needed, can you move them all around the continent? And that's what I've been looking at. And as always, when writing, journalists love to find like an interesting hook, a visual way of illustrating the subject we're looking at. And this is what I have essentially come up with, speaking to, I think I spoke to 3 retired generals, all involved in this sort of logistical world, and some fairly senior NATO officials as well. So what I found out is when France looked to deploy its troops to lead a new NATO battle group in Romania, its tanks were loaded onto trains ready to be sent across the continent, only to be held up at the German border. Since that point, the French, they have been reminding the military alliance that its credibility relies on being able to rapidly respond to threats. And this is what a senior NATO source told me, describing those French frustrations. You won't have a credible deterrence if the Russians know that we can't move a brigade without tanks being held up at the border. And this is actually a view that is shared amongst the upper echelons of NATO's leadership, who know that they will, in the first sort of plans that have been drawn up, they will be looking to raise some 500,000 troops to the eastern flanks, NATO's easternmost border, which is essentially Ukraine, Russia, that around the Baltics, Poland, Romania, etc. And I spoke to one of the retired generals I spoke to is Lieutenant General Ben Hodges. He's a former commander of the US Army in Europe, friend of the podcast, and he's now a NATO sort of mentor, advisor on logistics. And he said, look, you're trying to convey to the Russians that, hey, we see what you're doing. Don't make a terrible mistake. That is the idea of being able to push troops all the way across in a rapid way, doing it quickly, essentially. Troops and armaments, obviously. And then he goes on, Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, he goes on to say, look, it's about preventing a crisis and about giving our political leaders some other options than having to do a liberation campaign into the likes of Lithuania and Romania. So basically, NATO's, before the regional battle plans were drawn up out of the Madrid and Vilnius summits most recently, NATO's plan were essentially to have tripwire forces on the eastern flank. You would have Russia would steam in, likely be held up by the tripwire force, but the tripwire force wouldn't be strong enough to fully defend itself. So it would act as a tripwire, slowing the Russians down, basically giving enough time for the Americans to arrive and then reclaim that NATO territory. And as I said, last year's summit in Vilnius, NATO had been preparing some sort of 300,000 troops that be kept in high readiness and force structures that basically enable them to be reinforced and to bring in extra reserves, extra echelons of forces to basically keep up the fight, maintain that fight. But for this to all work, the old adage that infantry wins battles and logistics wins wars applies best. And not a shock to everyone, but railways are a key part of such logistics. So train lines are easily the fastest and most reliable way of moving large amounts of military equipment, vehicles across the country. I think one of the ways it was described to me by one of the generals, I can't remember off the top of my head who it was, but they basically said, look, you can't really take tracked vehicles down roads because they would soon trash the roads. And we're talking about moving troops and forces and the relative hardware in peacetime. This is to prevent a war. It's to act as a deterrent. It's not in initial response now. But what I did looking into this, basically, in peacetime, maneuvering of forces is basically a complex web, a logistical nightmare. And Germany has emerged as the major stumbling block. And that's purely a geographical thing. Germany basically straddles the whole gap between the West and the East. So everything has to go through Germany. But it's also a lot of the people I spoke to basically blamed the post-Cold War peace dividend, basically the idea that we no longer had to spend as much money on military budgets, and that could be funneled into other public services, healthcare, education, yada, 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 because we're essentially at peace. So Heinrich Braus, who's a retired lieutenant general in the German military, and he's a former NATO official responsible for defence planning, told me this: after the Cold War, we completely restructured our armed forces and to a large extent put aside everything we planned and exercised during the Cold War. So basically all the original plans to defend ourselves went out the window, and what money was spent was used to maintain battle groups and not on the less sexy logistical enablers, such as the universally compatible railway gauges and the kit to carry these things around, these big tanks around on these flatbed railway carriages, essentially. And one of my colleagues at another newspaper phoned me up to laugh, going, "How on earth did you get less sexy logistical enablers in copy without it being quoted?" So thank you to the Telegraph subs for that. But yeah, as I mentioned, Europe is basically war planning. It's planning its defence again, with like Russia progressing in Ukraine. It's moved its economy on a wartime footing. So look, plans are afoot of how to defend itself. So NATO is essentially looking at how it can shift as many as 100 brigades, so up to 500,000 men, into defensive positions to avert a crisis. So what you would do is you would get an initial 100,000 men would be moved to NATO's eastern border within the first 10 days. A second echelon would arrive to reinforce them in the first month, with a third tier of forces then being dispatched across the first 6 months. And then in the next year to come, I think someone told me it could be up to 2.5 million NATO forces available after you look at conscription, bringing everyone in together. But while civilian and commercial traffic moves freely around the EU Schengen travel zone at times of peace, there are no such arrangements that exist for the military. So you need customs declarations for tanks and artillery howitzers to enter Germany, which, as I said, because of its geography, is considered a roundabout of European defence. This shouldn't take long, but from reports, some say 3 to 4 weeks to get clearance, to get your tanks and howitzers moving through Germany. Diplomatic clearance is needed for any military movement greater than 50 troops and 10 vehicles. So essentially, if the Dutch are trying to move to Poland, they've got to go through Germany because that's the most logical route. They could easily be cast aside and sit on the sidings while they're waiting for their clearance. And then back to Germany, looking at the reliability of the country's Deutsche Bahn, which is held up there as one of these great sort of railways. It's cheap, you can get draft beer on its trains, etc. But actually, it's not as reliable as a military transporter as it is at transporting commercial freight and passengers. So this is what Hans Dammen, who's a retired brigadier general in the Dutch military, he said, "People complain, tanks don't." And then he went on to say, "What I am afraid of is if there is really a threat, Russia might not attack Europe, but it may accidentally cross the border of Poland. And at this point, what are we going to do? Are we going to wait and see whether the Deutsche Bahn has room on their railroads? Or are we waiting for diplomatic clearance for Hungary? I hope not, but I'm not sure if everything will go smoothly." So it's basically moving this military kit is at the whim of politicians and private companies. And so people in Germany, so back to Heinrich Braus, he did say the Germans have signed a agreement with Deutsche Bahn, which allows them to take over and give military traffic priority when needed. But we know that the German leadership is a bit hesitant when it comes to things like that. Just look at the row over Taurus missiles, or in the initial days of the war, it took Germany a week or so to decide it was actually going to start arming Ukraine instead of just sending it helmets. And then let's look a bit about why Deutsche Bahn might not be able to move as much military hardware across Europe as needed. So apparently Deutsche Bahn only has enough capacity to move 2 armored brigades, which I know me and Hamish, hello, and it's even listening. I've had a few conversations about this, but some of the maths that were given to me, because these were done on American calculations, 85 tanks and hundreds of armored vehicles at the same time. So yeah, that's not a lot of the 100 brigades that would be sought to move across Europe if needed. So Germany acts as that main throughway to Eastern Europe for American military hardware, landing in the Dutch port of Rotterdam. That's the sort of the main battle plan in place. Obviously, I will come to some of the different options later. So Berlin is trying to alleviate this concern. It has recently struck a deal with the Netherlands and Warsaw to develop a new military corridor to ease transport through Europe's North Sea ports to NATO's eastern flanks. So it aims to tackle the issues of this bureaucracy I'm talking about, or infrastructure, such as weak bridges, tunnels is a problem. In the Netherlands, you're not allowed to carry certain objects, mainly hazardous materials, through tunnels while shipping them, and apparently a 155mm ammunition artillery shell will count as hazardous because of its, I guess, big charge in it. So yes, so it's looking at the rules and regulations. And then back to NATO, one of its command structures, which is the Joint Support and Enabling Command, known as JSEC, it is brokering more of these deals, or more of these corridors around Europe, basically to make sure that NATO has the ability to move its kit through Europe in peacetime, because the European Union currently basically oversees military mobility in times of peace. So in the 5 years since JSEC was formed, it has carried out a review of Europe's infrastructure, basically making sure it can cope with the wider NATO plans of defence. It is creating these corridors, as I'm talking about, basically believe that for commanders so they can move troops as quickly to the eastern border to tackle a Russian threat. And then back to Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, who said, basically, we cannot also just rely on our sort of North Sea and Baltic ports, because, say, ports in the Netherlands, Germany, and the Baltic states are seen as particularly susceptible to, one, Russian missiles or a kinetic strike in the first days of war. But also, he said that you also have to look at the possibility of hybrid attacks. And that's one thing that lots of NATO leaders have been warning about. And that is Russia using hybrid methods to essentially trigger mass labor strikes at these ports. So other ports in France, Spain, Greece, Slovakia have all been seen as potential entry points to keep the Russians guessing. So I'm not revealing massively confidential information. You only have to look at the maps to see potential ports. And then, so yeah, just to then the last point, and much of this pressure about moving stuff around could be, and you'd think it's the logical way of doing things, alleviated by pre-positioning stocks. So ammunition warehouses, fuel warehouses across the continent spread around. But actually, interestingly, this is NATO military planners are really looking at the battlefield and the scenarios that have happened and played out in Ukraine and decided maybe that isn't the best option. And so moving things from rear to the front is always going to be best, because they have noted that Russia was able to take out nearly 80% of Ukraine's static supplies in the first days of the war after the full-scale invasion. And I will end on a quote from a NATO official, and it's like, look, if we don't get this right, we can't fight, talking about logistics. There's now a realization that we've been noticing everywhere that if the enablement piece is not ready, then we won't be able to execute our plans and we won't be able to deter properly. So basically, people are saying it's great to have and look at the sexiness of an F-35 fighter ship, a huge carrier strike group, or the latest battle tank. But actually, people are saying that maybe we should start looking at our railways, our flatbeds, logistics trucks, and start looking at ways we should get the kit we have to the front line if needed.
You're absolutely right, Joe. Logistics, I mean, whisper it quietly and just between the few hundred thousand of us, it's actually a really interesting subject and something that we just don't look at enough. I remember a mate of mine serving in the ARC headquarters, the Allied Rapid Reaction Corps, did a big exercise in Germany some years ago. And it was all the J3 Skywalkers, all the ops guys, sort of, oh, we'll do this, we'll push into here, we'll do that, we'll blitz that. And there was, my friend described, I think it was a Polish or German logistics officer, very senior officer, but just got up chuckling and just looked at the audience and said, you people have forgotten what it takes to move an army across any distance. And it's absolutely true. And you're talking there about NATO's Joint Support Enabling Command, so the group who are looking at how to move huge numbers of people and materiel across vast distances. And in the British military, I wonder who's looking at the same thing. And I wonder if it may well come under Strategic Command, what used to be called Joint Forces Command. So you've got your single services, your Army, Navy, your Air Force. When they all work together, they call it joint. So Joint Forces Command is when everyone's supposed to play nicely and everyone work together. And of course, the sort of colours of the Army is red, the Navy is dark blue, the Air Force is light blue. So when they're all working together, any joint organisation is called a purple organisation. It's a blend of the colours. So we've got Strategic Command here in the UK, previously called Joint Forces Command, but I've heard it nicknamed the purple skip, because you just chuck all the other old stuff. You got the Army has got its big tanks, and the Air Force has got its F-35s, and the Navy's got aircraft carriers, and all the boring stuff, all the logistics and the medical and all that kind of palaver, just chucked in the purple skip. And no one really looks at it. And I wonder how we do it. I should ask chums of mine if we're any better now than we were a few years ago. But yeah, whoever's heading up the NATO Joint Support Enabling Command, they have got possibly one of the most important jobs in NATO. And I wonder how big the staff is compared to the ops shop and intelligence and God knows what else. Anyway, Joe, whilst I've got you, before we move on to Jimmy, today, 120 years of the Entente Cordiale between the United Kingdom and France. We've got the Coldstream Guards in Paris today, the Lycée Palace. We've got French troops here. They've just done changing the guard at Buckingham Palace. It is a big deal. We're making a big deal of it. How big a deal is the UK-French military relationship in Brussels? Or is it just a quaint old sort of historical hernia?
No, I think it's apart from the pomp and the pageantry of sort of seeing the French guards in Buckingham Palace and the British guards changing over at the Elysee is sort of great to look at. And it does signify a sort of very important, if not turbulent, relationship and alliance that we have formed over the 120 years of the Entente Cordiale. You now find yourself, and you only have to look at the fact that Stéphane Séjourné, the French foreign minister, and David Cameron, Lord Cameron of Chipping Norton, our foreign secretary, have penned a joint op-ed before flying out to the US together. They see themselves as a leading part in potentially now the West's response to Ukraine, because the US is seen as differing. It's the Joe Biden lost control of Congress. And while everyone acknowledges that the US are the biggest military donors and the most important, and a lot of the battlefield failings are down to that sort of lack of money from Congress, they're not the sort of the figurehead of the response, because of their sort of, maybe Jake Sullivan's a bit tentative on causing an escalation that could reach nuclear levels. But the French and the British armed, we both clubbed together to make sure Storm Shadow Scout got to Ukraine. So the first sort of real long range weapons. The French could be criticised for many things in terms of them being a bit slow and not delivering enough, but they've raised the stakes. But I think it's just that idea. It seems to be maybe not a single leader in Europe at the moment, but maybe Britain and France are trying to plug the gap. In terms of, so I spent a brief minute with David Cameron the other day when he was at NATO for the 75th anniversary, and he was speaking about how he was pleased that the French had come and offering this change of rhetoric from negotiating with Putin to we have to do everything it takes to basically make a Ukraine victory possible. So I think that's sort of growing from strength to strength, that relationship, and it's actually really important in the sort of the geopolitical context of Ukraine.
Brilliant. I wonder if Lord Cameron and Stéphane Séjourné are the grown-ups I've been waiting for. Let's see. I was doing my own bit for the Entente Cordiale last week, spending an inordinate amount of money on cheese and Stella Artois in the French Alps. Now, it's great, very great pleasure to turn to, sorry to keep you waiting for so long, Jimmy. Jimmy Rushton, a Kyiv-based security analyst. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Delighted to have you on the pod. Please tell us where you are, what's happening with you, and talk us through this extraordinary story you've written for us about Russian use of illegal chemical weapons. Welcome, Jimmy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. So I'm currently in Kyiv at the moment. I've been living here for coming up to 2 years this month. And yeah, the story really was based around conversations that I had with Ukrainian soldiers and volunteers on the front line who were just incredibly frustrated that they were experiencing systematic chemical weapons attacks using tier agents and other agents as described in the piece, but that really nobody was talking about it, or the people that were talking about it were largely getting ignored. And this is something which it's nakedly illegal under the Chemical Weapons Convention. It's supposed to be one of those things that you simply just do not do. And I know you can argue that it's ridiculous to have rules in war, but these rules exist. Russia has signed up to the Chemical Weapons Convention, and we have Russian units conducting daily chemical weapons attacks on Ukrainian soldiers across the front line, from Kharkiv Oblast to Donetsk to Zaporizhzhia Oblast. And I spoke to 4 Ukrainian service personnel. I could have spoken to hundreds, and they would have told me the same things, that these attacks were happening. Unfortunately, they are effective. That's one of the reasons why the Russians keep doing them. The front lines have become relatively static. Progress is very incremental. Fighting is very positional. And the Ukrainians are, in most cases, very, very well dug in. So what the Russians are doing is that they're using these drone-dropped chemical weapons to force the Ukrainian soldiers to come out of their dugouts. Once they come out of their dugouts, then more drones drop conventional grenades or artillery is dropped on them, and they're getting killed. I mean, chemical weapons are killing Ukrainian soldiers directly and indirectly in Ukraine at the moment. And the reason, the motivation behind this story really was to amplify the Ukrainians that had been speaking about it and try to collate as much evidence as I could. So obviously we had the testimony, we had a physical K-51 tear gas grenade that was recovered and identified by independent chemical weapons expert, used to work for the NPCW. We also obviously have admissions from Russian state television and a Russian unit on Telegram that they do this and they do it and they find it effective. So yeah, it's really trying to shine some light onto this subject. And it's a shame really that it takes a Westerner like myself to write about it before people start taking it seriously. But those are the times we live in.
Yeah, Jimmy, I'll jump in something we were speaking about on tear gas the other day. And it's something that sort of, if you're a reporter, you've covered any protest in Europe. I think you were in Lebanon, Beirut for your experience. It's nasty stuff. And it's covered by these treaties, but nobody really ever takes note of it. And then I think you should also go through your ideas about how you can escalate from a inexperienced soldier moving from tear gas to then other nastier, more deadly and lethal substances.
Sure, absolutely. So tear gas is explicitly covered under the Chemical Weapons Convention. If it is used in warfare, it is considered a chemical weapon under the Chemical Weapons Convention. So there is no ambiguity there. There is also the case that the infrastructure that you would use for dropping tear gas can be very, very quickly adapted to drop other agents, far more lethal agents. There is also a variety of different tear agents. CS is the most common, but there is also chloropicrine, known as PS as well, which is a more lethal, significantly more lethal tear agent. And that was deployed as a chemical weapon by the Germans in the First World War. And yes, now I was tear gassed in Beirut at a protest, an anti-government protest there. And I tell you what, it's nasty stuff. And that's when you know what you're being gassed with, right? If you're at a protest and the police just deploy its tear agent, it's CS, it's not lethal. If you're a Ukrainian soldier and you're in a dugout and a Russian drone comes and drops a couple of grenades on you and it starts emitting a gas, you really have no idea what it is, especially if you're a Ukrainian soldier that's been drafted relatively recently. You probably haven't had extensive CPR training, or if at all, because the pressure really is to get people to the front and to train them on defensive tactics and assault tactics. So yes, it's incredibly nasty. The psychological element of these weapons, they really do create panic amongst Ukrainian soldiers. And the Ukrainian training doctrine now in regards to encountering a tear agent is to really just try and wait it out, because if you can really get over the panic, and again, if you have masks that are effective, and I unfortunately touch on this in the article, that a lot of the protective equipment that is supplied to Ukrainian soldiers is ex-Soviet. A lot of it doesn't work particularly well. A lot of the filters contain asbestos. But if you can get over the initial shock, wait out the most intense effects of the gas and try and avoid the follow-up conventional fire, which is always coming with these attacks, because it's not just chemical weapons that they deploy. They always have something waiting as the Ukrainian soldiers try to flee their dugouts. Then your chances of survival are much greater.
Jimmy, you mentioned the kit that the Ukrainian soldiers are, or in many, many cases, not carrying at the front to deal with this kind of threat. In the British military, we used to have our respirators on us the whole time. And the drill was, if you smell anything, what is it? Is it hydrogen cyanide that's supposed to smell of kind of
bitter almonds? Yeah. Hydrogen cyanide, yeah. Exactly. Phosgene, I believe, is the freshly mown grass. But yeah, you can sometimes detect them before they get to a lethal concentration.
Sure. So you see an odd smoke lingering in the air. If it's not a foggy day, there are explosions around you, which could indicate any kind of munition. You don't know if it's conventional or chemical. You put your respirator on, your gas mask, and it used to be in time, mask in nine was the old military mantra. So you get it on your face within 9 seconds and you stood a much better chance of survival. There were the wags that would say time is plenty, mask in 20, but they wouldn't have lasted very long. But is there any awareness, did you detect from people, that there are certain things you can do. I mean, as you said, you can wait it out. About 1 in 10 people are said to be immune to CS gas, and they could just put up with it. Very bizarre. So on training that we did, people would stand in the CS chamber as we all took our masks off and had to recite your military number and then say your football team and what you had for dinner last night, by which time you're coughing and all the rest spluttering. And one person would be absolutely fine. But there are some things you can do. Firstly, get over the panic. And secondly, if you can put up with the streaming eyes, you can cover your mouth and nose with a cloth, which will offer some protection. Is there any kind of awareness that you saw picked up by the people in the front lines? Or is it just a totally new area of military activity that they'd never been exposed to before?
At the start, it was definitely something new, but there is increasing awareness now because it's just happening so often. And what you're seeing is volunteers that are raising money for protective equipment. You're seeing soldiers in some cases. Mikhail, the commander of the infantry unit that I spoke to outside of Robotnik, he purchased his own gas mask because he wanted the best protection that he could afford. So really, it is a case of on a unit-by-unit basis. Some units are better prepared than others. Mikhail, again, he makes sure that all of his soldiers, when they go to position, they have to have their protective equipment, and they do random inspections to make sure that they're carrying them. But in some cases, Ukrainian soldiers have to walk 10, 12, 13, 14 kilometers to get to their positions. And if you're carrying gas masks, it's less ammunition that you can take or other equipment. So at least in the beginning, it wasn't seen to be a priority because they didn't believe that this would happen. Again, there is supposed to be rules against this stuff. It wasn't something that they were really prepared for psychologically or in regards to equipment. But that is starting to change. But the sheer size of the Ukrainian army and the number of men that they've taken under arms, they just don't have enough equipment. And the equipment that they have is just not good enough, unfortunately.
Yeah, Jimmy, maybe we could speak about some of the sort of the efforts. I think we were speaking about volunteers that were trying to deliver these items. Because, again, it's one of those items where it's not, and I'm sure it's not on the top of the shopping list for when President Zelensky and his defense minister is going and drawing up these lists to go to the US-led Ramstein at NATO and stuff like that. They're asking for like artillery ammunition, air defense, armored vehicles and stuff. These gas masks are probably quite low down on the priority list, mainly because there's not been a lot of awareness around what's being used on the battlefield. So yeah, so sort of what sort of volunteers have you come across trying to deliver into the country?
Yeah, absolutely. Volunteers are absolutely crucial to the Ukrainian war effort, and it's from small one-man band organizations up to very large organizations like Come Back Alive, and they do supply absolutely critical equipment from gas masks to Starlink internet connections to FPV drones. And yes, one of the aid organizations that the people that I know pretty well, at the start of the full-scale invasion when they were doing these aid runs, they didn't really deliver any gas masks or filters. And now, at least I'd say on the last trip, at least half of the aid that they were distributing was these gas mask filters. Because the thing about gas masks as well is that you can't just give a soldier a gas mask and a filter and that's not the end of it. You have to, because filters only last a certain amount of time when they're exposed to an agent, so they have to be constantly replaced. And in some cases, some Ukrainian soldiers told us that the gas mask filters were only lasting for, say, 30 minutes when they were being exposed to these chemical agents. So there's a logistical demand that's created by the use of these weapons as well. So again, in regards to what you're saying about the shopping list, I would probably agree it's probably not at the top of the list. But for Ukrainian soldiers, they are critical because they, again, the psychological feeling of going into a trench fighting position when you know the enemy is using chemical weapons and you don't have the right equipment, it's very difficult to feel confident in those situations. So any help that the Western governments can do, and this could be something that a lot of Western governments or a lot of countries around the world don't feel comfortable giving lethal aid to Ukraine. For example, the Irish government doesn't want to give any lethal aid to Ukraine because they cite their neutrality. Fair enough. They could donate CBRM equipment, gas masks, because that is lethal aid. It would just protect Ukrainian soldiers. It has no offensive potential. But it is very important and something needs to be done.
Thanks, Jimmy. Just one final one for me before we start to wrap up. So you're in Kyiv now, but I think you've been zipping around in recent weeks. So what's the mood? Take the temperature for us, please. We're coming out of winter, pretty much into spring now. So the much vaunted attack on Ukraine's energy infrastructure, it didn't work. Ukraine's got through the winter. Kharkiv is under the cosh at the moment in terms of energy. But we're starting to move into the summer. What is the mood as you've detected going around the country, and where have you been recently?
So I've been to Kharkiv, and then from Kharkiv, I really followed the front line down all the way down to Zaporizhzhia Oblast and spoke to people outside of Kyiv. And yeah, I'm going back to Kharkiv actually at the end of this week, because again, that's another story that's really being, I mean, it's being reported, but there aren't really that many Western journalists in Ukraine anymore, unfortunately. Gaza has really dominated the story, has dominated attention. So I'll be going there to do some reporting from Kharkiv, because as you mentioned, that city is getting absolutely pounded. It's a city of 1.5 million people, and the Russians are attempting to render it uninhabitable by destroying critical infrastructure. And one of the thermal power plants has been completely destroyed. We're coming into summer. Temperatures are pretty mild in Ukraine now, but when it comes to winter, Kharkiv is going to be extremely cold. And if there is no aid, air defense systems that are provided, some form of humanitarian aid for the people of Kharkiv, it's going to be incredibly difficult for a lot of those people to live in that city during winter. I know that the mayor of Kharkiv, he says that they're not going to leave, but I know some people that are already leaving. In regards to the overall mood, so the Ukrainian soldiers that I've spoken to, their holding is extremely tough. The Russians have been increasingly using aerial bombs, glide bombs, which the Ukrainians really have no answer to. They have to really just button up in their foxholes and take it. They're launched, you know, miles and miles behind the front lines, and the only thing that the Ukrainians could possibly do is push up Patriot and other long-range air defense systems close to the front. But in that case, they leave them vulnerable to being destroyed by the Russians as well. So until the F-16s arrive, and hopefully the F-16s are given enough sophisticated air-to-air missiles to deter these glide bombing attacks, it's going to be very difficult. And the Russians are still pushing hard. They have seemingly no regard to the losses they are taking. And despite the fact they are taking horrendous losses, they are grindingly advancing. And there's one soldier in the 3rd Assault Brigade, a friend of mine called Oleg, he said that in some cases they literally have more soldiers than we have bullets. Make of that what you will. How do you fight an enemy that has seemingly not infinite, but extensive manpower and material, and no regard for the amount of manpower and material they expend? Especially when you have allies like the United States, which have really completely let Ukraine down. Let's be clear. The United States has behaved, and this is a perspective inside Ukraine. It's also my perspective, but the way that the United States has slow-walked aid into Ukraine, military aid into Ukraine, and the way that they still have some presidential Dordogne authority that they could use to send aid to Ukraine, which they're not using. And meanwhile, Ukrainian soldiers are fighting a desperate war of attrition in the trenches with not enough artillery support, not enough chemical weapons, protective equipment, not enough bullets in some cases. So yeah, it's difficult, but the Ukrainian soldiers that I spoke to, they are incredibly determined. I mean, their perspective is we have to fight because we have no other choice. The alternative to fighting is living under Russian occupation. And that's something they know what living under Russian occupation looks like, because a lot of them have friends that are currently under occupation. A lot of them, they've all seen the scenes in Bucha and Borodyanka and Irpin. So they're still what they're determined, but we are not doing enough to help them.
Thanks, Jimmy. Links me somewhat neatly to my final thought. We'll go around final thoughts now, if I may. And I was just going to say, it's amazing what a week's distance can do in terms of perspective. So I was away last week, as you may know, but I come back, Ukraine is still on the defensive, mainly going backwards, albeit in very small measures. And Russia, as Jim has just said, Russia is being made to pay very dearly for any advance, as evidenced by last week's disastrous attempts to mount armoured assaults and so on. So it's a chaotic and violent mess at the front. Neither side, but especially Russia, shows no sign of an imminent breakthrough. However, the clarity of time away from work gives you, the picture outside the country looks much clearer to me. And I'm sorry to say, as a massive fan of the United States, and someone who has stood shoulder to shoulder with US forces on operations on 9/11 in Macedonia and subsequently in Iraq and Afghanistan. The US right now, I would say, is not a reliable security partner. What I mean by that, we currently have a Biden administration that won't even apply strategic ambiguity as to whether or not it supports Ukrainian strikes into Russia. And there's a speaker who's doing everything to stop aid to Ukraine. And I would just say that I don't think you can't have it both ways. Now, I don't expect to hear much in public, but if this administration accepts that the aid issue is just a can to be kicked down the road until the next election possibly dooms any future aid for Ukraine, they should, in private, be messaging Kyiv that their hands are tied politically and that Ukraine cannot rely on US support. So that's, if that's the position they are honest with themselves about, that's what they should be doing. That they are being so open about their opposition and this restriction, some of Jake Sullivan's recent comments about escalation and what have you. Escalation is real, but at the same time, I think there should be a more nuanced approach. I think if they were honest with Ukraine and they said, we can't help you, well, to say to them now, we can't help you, but you mustn't do X or Y, it's just an impossible position. They should pick one side and be honest about it. And that's what I mean about being reliable. They should either say to Ukraine, look, we can't do anything right now, so off you go, fellas, do what you think is best. It's existential for you if you want to strike inside Russia. And I'm saying this should be behind closed doors. But the fact that they're being so open about opposing that position, I think that is their genuine position, because it just sets themselves up in competition with Ukraine if they carry on doing it as they're doing. So I just don't think the US is stepping up right now. And that is a great, great shame, as I say, for a massive fan of the United States. Europe, you're still on the naughty step as well. Good words today. Great words today, I think, from Lord Cameron and Stefan Séjourné. And well done, Peter Pavel from Czech Republic, for finding 1 million artillery shells down the back of the sofa. But come on, 75 years, almost to the day after the founding of NATO, I just say to the West, the external support of Ukraine, is this the best you can do? This is not good, fellas. We need to do better. Okay, sorry, rant over. Joe Barnes, please, final thoughts.
Yeah, I won't go through it because it's not my piece, and maybe Roland could be on this week to speak about it. But our friend, colleague Roland Oliphant, has done a really incredible look at what will happen if the US turns its back on NATO, and basically see what Joe Biden US is doing to Ukraine. What does a Donald Trump US, potentially elected for his second term later this year, mean for the Pax Americana, which is basically the idea that every Western power around the world has hinged their security off of the back of the US. And yes, a really insightful takes from Roland, from various analysts he's spoken to, so I really recommend that. It's on the website, Telegraph website. It's titled 1945 in Reverse, What Will Happen If the US Turns Its Back on NATO? So yeah, recommended reading if you have some time this afternoon, later on this week. But then I want to look back at some of the intelligence nuggets that I picked up last week while floating around NATO to celebrate its 75th anniversary. And Dom, you were speaking about the cost that Russia has basically put on itself to make these minimal gains. And here's just some of that cost in numbers. Russian casualties, ones that are actually going through the system, have caused this vast spike in Russians claiming disability allowance, essentially. So this, according to a senior NATO official, saying just according to Russian pension statistics alone, and this is from 2022 to 2023, the number of men aged 31 to 59 with disabilities in Russia increased by 30%. That is 507,000. And then sort of drilling into the killed and wounded statistics, apparently Russians have suffered about 350,000 killed and wounded. And then there were some numbers last year put out by the British Ministry of Defence as part of one of their British Defence Intelligence updates, which said it was likely 70,000 Russian soldiers have been killed. The NATO official basically said this is probably on the low end of estimates. So while Russia is advancing, it's done at this almighty cost. It's not going swimmingly for them as well. But it does highlight what could Ukraine do if it's actually given the right equipment, the right munitions, and the right backing from its Western allies in terms of moving forward to win this war.
Thanks, Joe. Jimmy, as our guest, would you like the very final thought?
Thank you. I would just like to say that the thank you to everyone that actually still pays attention to what's happening in Ukraine. It's incredibly critical that we don't let politicians especially forget about this country, because what's happening here, it's a criminal act of aggression against a country that literally just wants to live away from its ex-imperialistic master. And we have to support them in this fight. If you don't want to support them in this fight for just simple moral reasons, I would say support them for practical reasons, because Russia, it's an imperialistic aggressive power, and it's not going to stop with Ukraine. It's not going to be satisfied if it conquers all of Ukraine, that Putin is not going to say, well, I'm done now. History has taught us that. Then aggressive expansionist dictators are never satisfied with just one more piece of land.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To support our work and to stay on top of all our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, please subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/Ukraine the Latest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our foreign affairs newsletter, bringing stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website, where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. We also do the same for other breaking international stories. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so that you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload, so if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it's released, do refer to podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app and leave us a review, as it helps others find the show. Please also share it with those who may not be aware we exist. As a disinformation war ramps up, we are relying on your support more than ever. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do continue to read every message. You can also contact us directly on X, formerly Twitter. You can find our handles in the description for this episode. As ever, we are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was today produced by Rachel Porter. Executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.